And we begin tonight with theatre. A reluctant rebel is how our first guest has described himself. Lee Brewer is one of the leading theatre directors, in a sense, theatre makers in the United States. Famous, at one point infamous, for his productions of Beckett, he now runs the theatre group Mabu Minds, and their production, A Prelude to Death in Venice, Harvey's version, has been running here in Kilkenny. I saw it earlier tonight, and I'm joined now by Lee Brewer. Lee, a terrific show. Tell me how you came to make it. Tell me a little bit about it.
Okay. This is a strange little show, and it's part of a longer work, a book that I'm still writing, and it's kind of metaphorically autobiographical. But there's a lot of references that are very important to me. I'm pretty old, and I grew up in the 60s, and I was in San Francisco right through the Summer of Love, and life was very different at that point. And when I came to New York, most of the Summer in Love types had drifted over to New York. And they were kind of romantics, I guess no longer beatniks or hippie romantics, we could call them. And most of these kids would camp out in the parks in New York, and they seemed kind of lonely and lost. But every one of them was looking for an intimate contact. And one by one, they would pick up dogs, little puppies that they would carry around. I don't think they could relate too well to each other, but they certainly related to these dogs very well. And I was totally fascinated. I became very close to a guy who lived on the street, and I think he was from Canada, and he said he used to be a filmmaker, but he was an alcoholic by the time we met him. He just lived on the street under a tarp, and he had a dog, and they never left each other.
They were in a sense, they were in love.
They were totally in love, and it was a match made in heaven, because I don't think that one of his own species would have done very well with this guy. But the dog seemed to be the perfect match. But suddenly, the idea of a modern view of something like Dollhouse was really starting to appear to me. That the love of this dog was so total, and the mastery of this guy, who could probably master nothing else in the world, was so total that and they started to set up an interaction that was very much like the kind of couple that Ibsen describes. And then just as Nora did in Dollhouse, the dog one day broke her choke collar chain and ran away. And this poor guy was beyond devastation. He would wander around with a leash, with the collar, with nothing in the collar, and walk this leash up and down the street, getting drunker and drunker, and kept calling the phone and, you know, try to reach girlfriends. And he wasn't sure he was talking to animals or girlfriends, you know, by that particular time. And I just thought, well, this is the new feminist parable, you know? This is, if we can just abstract the idea of the interaction between man and woman to the interaction of all animals, we've got a real new take, a kind of a surrealist, almost pataphysical take, on the feminist parable.
And it reminded me in some ways of Albee's The Goat. I mean, this transgressive
right.
love, a human and
Edward,
an animal.
You know, Edward, who I know a bit, has the same take on life. Edward Albee's been very influential to me. When I was a kid, I saw his little one act, which really, the dog story, which really moved me, you know, a lot. And I'm sure many of these influences go into a piece of work like this. Also, as people pointed out, it feels a little bit like latter-day beat poetry from the 60s, the kind they used to read to jazz. And in point of fact, I've got this magnificent jazz singer who's actually singing and speaking the poetry, you know, as we go. So it's a very lyric and actually very referential, you know, idea that I'm kind of putting into the mind of a dog, and the dog is a narrator and the lead character.
I thought it was very moving, actually. And there is this sense of tragedy, love and tragedy. All the great themes are there.
Thank you very much. You know, I particularly like this idea of giving wide, subtle, and particularly dramatic monologues to animals, because I kind of picked it up from kind of Kafka's animal stories. I mean, it just didn't stop at his you know, the insect story, but he had a story about jackals and Arabs. He had a story about, the burrow, about this beaver-like character. And so I think the first impulse to write these kind of intellectual monologues for animals came from these Kafka stories.
You know. You mentioned the beats there, beat poetry, and of course, what I think in September it'll be 50 years since the first publication of On the Road. Now, you were there at that time.
I knew Jack, and I also knew Alan very well. My closest friend, were there. I directed Ferlinghetti's first play in San Francisco. So I go back all the way to the Beats, and it was fascinating to see the culture change in a way from the Beatniks to the hippies, because, you know, they were very, very different. The Beatniks were all literary. They're all poets. They're all very well read. And the hippies were totally into rock and roll. They were music, you know. Mm. And so the culture changed, and the style of dress changed, and whatever drugs they were doing changed, and the whole business kind of changed. But I've done a lot of teaching since then. I was at Yale Drama School for a while, and at Columbia, and at Stanford. And all of my students kind of look at this period in America as an iconic period. They really feel that that was the point that America had something to say, that America had some sort of, energy and romantic gesture that would be equivalent to Paris in 1915, and when all the painters, except instead of painters, it was musicians. There were all these rock and rollers. Rock and roll was invented there. There was the Fillmore West. There was all of this stuff. And so it became this period that everybody looks back with nostalgia. All of my kids, these students, says, I wish I'd lived then. I wish I'd been in San Francisco in the 60s. So I feel very lucky. I was there as a kid. I was 19 when I got there. I was about 27 when I left. And it changed my life, and this play came out of it.
Mm. You also directed some of Beckett's short plays.
Yes,
early
I did.
On.
We had a series that we did of Beckett called Mambo Minds Direct Samuel, Sage of Samuel Beckett, and it included Come and Go, and it had the most important part of the series was our adaptation of Beckett's short story, Le Deux Peuples, The Lost Ones.
Yes.
And I was lucky enough.
Which was quite controversial.
I was lucky enough to find a tape that we did 25 years ago that we thought was lost. And there it was, performance by David Warlow, who was considered by the time he died, which was about 15 years ago, to be perhaps the best Beckett actor in America. Mm-hmm. Beckett wrote Ohio Impromptu for David, and David was bilingual, and he could perform Beckett in both French and English. That play stayed in repertory 12 years and then was copied and performed in French, so he had almost a 20-year life.
Mm, it's a great play. But tell me about that initial controversial production of The Lost Ones. Beckett wasn't too happy.
No. This is what happened. Gene Reeve, who was my friend and a friend of Beckett's at the time, David and I were really interested in this short story, and we asked him if it was possible to do a reading. Well, when we started working on it, the reading got a little bit more dramatized, a little bit more dramatized, a little bit more dramatized. And lo and behold, by the time we'd finished, it was a play. And it was a little frayed because, Gene had assured him that it would be a straight reading, and he was very nervous because Beckett doesn't like anybody who adapts his stuff. And so Deirdre Baird, when she wrote the biography of Beckett, quoted him in a letter to Gene Reeve saying, "A pretty crooked straight reading." And so we wrote this phenomenal apology, and we went back and we met him. And lo and behold, many of his friends came and said they loved it. In fact, it was invited by Jean-Louis Barrault to be performed for his 70th birthday. And then it went, and Jimmy Faye saw it at the Pompidou, where it was being shown for his 100th anniversary there, and it was shown every day for a month. And by that time, I guess it was part of the Beckett canon, And what happened was that Beckett came and visited us when we were performing it in Berlin, and he saw all the little figures, and he met David, and they got very close. And, he finally said, "I approve. I'm fair," but it was a long turn. He was a tough one, boy. He really wants to keep control of that stuff, and I fully understand, because you can just wreck him if you do it the wrong way.
Do you ever feel it's too controlled, though, that the Beckett estate is too controlling of how the plays are done?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. I think it's controlled in the same way the Joyce Estate is controlled. It's controlled by an academic community that wants to preserve this pristine image of the great artist, you know, and not have anything ever change and not have it develop, which I think is a mistake because things have life if they allow contemporary artists to enter into them and to bring their own creativity to, you know, to the work. We just, for example, finished doing a play at Mabu Minds based on Lucia, Joyce's daughter, and all of her writings about her father. And, of course, Lucia was in a nut house for 40 years, and there were all sorts of rumors about the relationship with the father and this and that and stuff like that. Well, we were really scared because, you know, maybe the Joyce Estate would come really down on us, and we don't know. You know, we're waiting for that letter in the mail, cease and desist, you know. So, but I do feel that it came off wonderfully with Samuel Beckett because he appreciated the work. He realized that we were incredibly sincere, that we loved the work, that I'm absolutely floored by his writing, and that he was the master. And that we try to do him justice.
Talk to me about your own theater company, Mabu Minds. Where did that name come from?
Well, curiously enough, it was a joke. Because when we were in 1970 and we were all flooded back to New York, and we wanted to start a small troupe, Philip Glass, who was our composer at that time, and screenwriter Rudolph Wurlitzer, were just buying a property for the summer, in Mabu Minds, Nova Scotia, and we invited us up there to come and rehearse our first piece. We were then part of La Mama. We were a troupe of La Mama. Ellen Stewart was our sponsor, and we went up there. And lo and behold, a month before we left, they lost the lease and they got a new house in Margaret Forks. By that time, it was too late to change the name to Margaret Forks.
Wouldn't have worked as well.
And I don't think so. So we kept it Mabu Minds, but we've never been to Mabu Minds. A lot of New York artists did go to Mabu Minds, and it became a kind of a little summer hangout for New York artists. But Margaret Forks ended up where we were, how we rehearsed. It was the Red Horse Animation that we rehearsed there, the first of the series.
So it's always a phrase I'm reluctant to use, but you're regarded very much as avant-garde. I think you just make theater, and I think you make very fine theater.
I understand that the word avant-garde is the word they gave to those soldiers they pushed in front of the army, and it's called cannon fodder. So one way to look at the avant-garde is they are the cannon fodder of theater. You push them out there and shoot them down so you don't get to the real troops, you know, kind of thing. So
they're pushing you out ahead of Broadway.
Right. Yeah. Out there. Seriously enough, that metaphor actually holds because we do take the rap for a lot of things in theater that 5 to 10 years later are accepted. Mm. I remember when Joe Papp did Chorus Line. The staging of, you know, he was our patron for 6 years. And the staging of Chorus Line, the mirror, the interaction with the audience was all avant-garde stuff 10 years before that. They just started lifting it all. And lo and behold, it went to Broadway. Lo and behold, it was a big hit. Mm. You know, but because the public catches up, and it usually catches up 10 or 15 years later, you know. So as things move, the best way to look at it is if theater was a Detroit car industry like General Motors or like Ford, the avant-garde would be the laboratory that invented a new bumper, you know? The laboratory invented a new spotlight. And out of 200 bumpers, one of them will go on those cars and make a fortune. The other 99 will be thrown away, you know? So that's what the avant-garde is. The interesting thing is about the industry, if there was a car industry, the laboratory would be subsidized. But in New York, it's not subsidized. Yes. And even though Broadway steals all of our stuff that really makes money, they don't subsidize us. So we end up kind of missing the boat financially.
Yeah, but you forge ahead. I mean, you can see the production values there tonight are certainly very impressive. You also have a show in Edinburgh.
Yes, in the 22nd. Dollhouse opens in Edinburgh, and then luckily enough, right after Edinburgh, we are going to film it for ARTA, French-German Television, which is all very exciting. So this is our kind of our worldwide hit right now. We're running around the world touring this. And Nikki Novicki, The little person who played John tonight is our major understudy, and I have three other fabulous little people. You see, the interesting thing about that concept is the men are only 3'5",
yes,
and the women are almost 6 feet tall. And on the love scenes, the women have to pick up the
men
and carry them around.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. Yes.
So what happens is that all of this kind of the patriarchy is viewed very ironically. All you have to do is see the two, you know, man and woman standing next to each other, and you start looking at everything that Ibsen's put down quite ironically, and it works pretty well. Mm. I'm really proud of it. Mm.
I suppose some people would probably describe some of what we saw tonight as postmodern, and there's a great quote I read from you where you said, you don't have to be cold, cynical, and Euro-trashy to be postmodern.
Well, I saw a lot of so-called postmodern work in Europe, and most of it was the same. Everyone was wearing an overcoat and a hat, and had a cigarette, and they would stand in very dramatic light over in the corner. And I thought, well, that's not my style. I like music, I like emotion, and I love good acting.
Mm.
And a lot of postmodern shows I've seen negated that. They wanted to produce a kind of a dark, negativistic, anti-acting kind of approach, mostly visual stances and images of this sort. So I wanted to make it very clear that though we are called postmodern, we're not of that style. And I that's more like Bobby Wilson's style a little bit, you know. But Bobby is a little bit more colorful than that. So, yes, I would like to say we're postmodern. No, I'd like to say we're not the European version of that. You know?
No, they can be postmodern and timeless. How do you see the role of the sort of theater that you make in modern day, in the modern day United
well,
States,
you know,
in Bush's
it's pretty America. Ancient as well as modern because I do narrative theater. I like to tell stories. I like to tell stories through monologues. And that goes back to theater other than Europe. I mean, Asian theater, Japanese theater. I learned a tremendous amount studying in Japan because the narrator, just like Burnett, was over here, and the puppetry, for example, in Bunraku was over here, and, you know, there's a storyteller with a demonstration. It's almost like a narrator with a slideshow, and the slideshow is the theater itself. So I love this style, and I wanted to try to incorporate that into Western work.
Mm. Have you had a good time in Kilkenny?
Fabulous time, and my company had a fabulous time, so we want to thank you. You are incredibly good hosts, and we felt very warm and very
well. It was a terrific reception tonight. It was great to have you here as well.
Thank you.
Really great to see you making this kind of theater. You know, we need it. We need it here. We need it everywhere. Lee Brewer, thanks very much indeed
thanks
for joining
so
us.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.